7, 8.
Okay, we'll come to order the Public Safety Crime Prevention Policy and Finance. And we'll start out with the roll call.
Representative Cornish?
Here.
Representative Johnson?
Here.
Representative Considine?
Here.
Representative Dean?
Here.
Representative Flanagan? Representative Hertas? Representative Hillstrom?
Here.
Representative Howe? Representative Lohmer?
Here.
Representative Lucero?
Here.
Representative Neuberger?
Ready to serve.
Representative O'Neill?
I'm here.
Representative Quam?
My bills.
Present.
Representative Rosenthal? Oh, here. Representative Schoen? Representative Ward? And Representative Zerwas?
Here.
Okay. Somebody want to make a motion to approve the minutes of April 5th?
So moved, Chair.
Representative O'Neill moves the minutes of April 5th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, first up, Representative Pugh, House File 3308. Chair will move House File 3308 to the general, referred to the general register. Any amendments? And we have an amendment, the A2 amendment. Chair will also move the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Representative Pugh to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the Public Safety Committee. Thanks for hearing my bill, House File 3308. It's been said, and I'd agree, based on the number of friends I know who have experienced family court, that regardless of the outcome, there really are no real winners. The process of litigation and hearings takes a toll on families, and neither are best practices for people to settle their divorce. It's expensive, it's stressful, not to mention the time it can take to get a court date. A lot of conflict can occur due to the adversarial court process. In the interest of well-being of families, my bill seeks to improve upon this process. I believe that consistent use of alternative dispute resolution, or ADR, could result in more favorable and less contentious outcomes for families versus the traditional court process. After all, after the divorce is final, the parties need to be able to effectively communicate in order to co-parent their children. The purpose of this bill is to educate people about and to inform them that they have an option of using mediation. As committee members are surely aware, there are a growing number of pro se litigants, individuals who are representing themselves in court, many of whom cannot afford an attorney and are simply not aware of their option to use mediation. In fact, I recently met with Melissa Cantola, staff attorney at the Hennepin County Self-Help Center, who informed me that their office offered legal advice, free legal advice, to over 20,000 people just last year alone. Alternative dispute resolution refers to any means of settling or resolving disputes outside of the courtroom and any method of resolving disputes other than by litigation. Mediation and arbitration are the two forms of ADR. So ADR is a process that can be used to resolve a family law matter instead of going to court, a process which encourages parties to resolve their differences so that the judge doesn't have to make their decisions for them. The main advantage of this form of dispute settlement is that it allows the parties themselves to control the process and the solution. According to Court Rule 310, and I believe members should have a copy of that in their packets, all family law matters in district court are required to use an ADR process to resolve their divorce case, except for certain cases. And I have a copy of that rule, the copy of the rule that you have clarifies that ADR is not required in cases involving domestic abuse. Although many people are aware of their option to use mediation and ADR, many are not informed. My bill requires the court to do a little something different other than what they've been doing, for the judge to provide an informational form as well as the ADR requirements in the general rules of practice, to use the parties regarding their use of ADR instead of using the court process. And this form will be given to them by the judge at their first hearing with the court. And most of the time, this will be at the initial case management conference, or the ICMC. So I think I have a sample of that in your packets as well. That's what the form may look like. However, we'll be working with the courts to draft the final version of that form prior to this being enacted. I also want the committee to know that subsequent to my last hearing, I requested a fiscal note, and the fiscal note has been received. I don't know if that's in your packets, yep. But it came back at zero. So I appreciate your support for this bill, which I believe will really ultimately benefit families. And I believe that if more would choose to use mediation instead of the court process, there'd be a reduction in the use of the court calendar, and therefore a reduction in the cost that we are incurring as a state to the courts, not to mention to families. So, Mr. Chair, I do have a number of testifiers, and the first that I would like to request your consideration is Marilyn McKnight, who would briefly explain the benefits of mediation.
Briefly, that would be great. We've got seven bills to go through, and Representative Considine, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just a quick one. I really like the bill. I think it's a great idea, and I've had friends go through long, bitter divorces, 3 years, $50,000. Would this at all slow down the process for somebody who really wants to get out of a marriage?
Representative.
Mr. Chair and Representative Considine, you know, I would defer to the experts here who have worked in the family courts. If anything, the statistic that I shared with you, I'm not sure if your question is with regard to somebody who's representing themselves on a pro se basis, but you know, based on my conversation with the staff attorney at Hennepin County Courts, that they provide free feedback to 20,000 people on an annual basis, that slows down the courts. More and more people representing themselves pro se, frankly, I think, than anything else. I'm not an attorney, so maybe my testifier could, who works in the family courts, could answer that question better than I.
Representative Constantine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I get real specific. Somebody that's in an abusive situation will just stop them from getting out at any point.
Yeah.
Or slow it down, rather, I mean.
Representative Pugh?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Considine, I am going to defer to somebody who works in the courts and could give you a much better answer than I.
Thank you.
Ma'am, your name and organization, and go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representatives, I'm Marilyn McKnight. I'm owner of Erickson Mediation Institute. We're located in Bloomington, 494 in France, and we were the first mediation practice to open Minnesota in 1977. We were the third practice to open the country and brought mediation to Minnesota. We have been mediating divorces and many, many other issues. We started the whole farm mediation process. Since that time, we've mediated probably somewhere around 4,000 divorces over the years. And a couple of things. I can't see where this would slow down people wanting to get divorced right away, because most of the people in mediation will do their mediation in a matter of a couple of weeks to 6 months or 6 weeks, and then they will get their paperwork filed and end up in court as soon afterward, depending on the county court's calendar. So it's a much faster process. If people want to go quickly, they may. So it's much faster than any court process that I know of. Secondly, on domestic violence, we mediators in Canada and the United States in the early 90s resolved the issue of mediating domestic violence cases. We mediate them routinely, not had any issues of domestic violence during mediation or after, and all mediators are screened for domestic violence so that they know right away what they're dealing with. And if they're not going to mediate that case because the mediator doesn't feel comfortable, they can refer it on or insist that lawyers be present or whatever.
Confident.
So no, it doesn't. thank you, Mr. Chair.
Now, did you want one of your testifiers to go out at the regular testifying?
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you.
Briefly.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representatives, I'll try to be brief. In my work as a divorce mediator and trainer of mediators since 81, What we have found is that mediation works very, very well in divorce and many other areas, but particularly in divorce. It's been researched over and over again and found to be a good process. People are very satisfied with it. It comes through in all the research. The problem is, I still see a lot of people who come to my office. We do an informational divorce session weekly. And they come in and they say, how come I've never heard of this? What is this all about? Is this new? And I'm saying, you know what? It's not new. You should have heard about it. It's mandated that you use an ADR process before you even get into the court. And they've not heard about it. So I think the reason we want to have this bill is that we start telling people that this exists and that it works. And that's probably the most important reason we want this bill to go forward.
Okay. Former Representative Anderson, go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Diane Anderson. I was a former state representative, been very active in these family law issues for a long time and have helped pass other legislation. And since my previous testifier did such a great job and just mainly here for questions, just wanted to tell you this bill is just to give people do something different than the courts are doing now. There is a form that the courts have now, but it just says, you know, what process are you using? And what we're trying to do with this piece of legislation is to give the parties more information at the initial case management hearing. As a legislator, I sat in on some case management, early case management hearings in Dakota County, and the judge would say, do you want to go to the E&E process? Do you want to go to the court process? And they didn't tell them that they also have the option to go to mediation. So it's just a really, you know, a little form that we want the judges to hand to the parties and say, look, here's some more information about the mediation process. And so hopefully that will encourage a lot of these pro se people who aren't aware of it to use mediation. And so that's really what we're trying to do with this bill. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. Members, questions? Without any questions, Representative Pugh, a short closing.
Yes, thank you, Chairman Cornish. Well, this is a really good bill. I would greatly appreciate your support. There were 15,600 dissolution cases filed in 2015, and 7,800 of them were in the five-county metro area. So if this bill can move the needle forward, which I absolutely believe that it will, minimize the cost to courts, and maybe more importantly, assist families, then I say it's a great bill, and I encourage your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Pugh, and testifiers. Anybody from the public have anything? Okay, without that, the chair will renew the motion on House File 3308 as amended to move to the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, committee.
Representative Petersburg. House File 2014. Chair will move
amendments.
Chair will move your bill, House File 2014, to be referred to Ways and Means. Is that your understanding, Representative?
That is correct. That's what I understand.
Okay, Representative Petersburg, to your bill.
Thank you, Chair Cornish, and members of the committee for hearing this bill. This bill is what I believe is a simple due process bill, one that allows for opportunities for members of the community and constituents to have an appeals process from departments that have the full weight of the state government behind them, which I think is always important to do. Basically, what this bill is gives neutral party appeal process for when businesses, which could also be farmers, etc., when there is a dispute over the ability to have access of a driveway into their business or potential future business, when that has been denied by the Department of Transportation. This just gives them another avenue to do so. This bill was introduced last year. It was passed in the Senate as well last year. And since then, the Department of Transportation has certainly realized that there was a shortcomings in their appeals process, and through the interim has done a very good job of creating an internal appeals process that I think will really alleviate some of the concerns and questions in the future. These are not a large number of appeals that we're talking about, but for those, they're very important. And basically, again, what this bill does is it allows it to go to district court to have the determination being made there. During the last committee at civil law, legal counsel did comment that going to district court and the clear and convincing of evidence is a preponderance that is more difficult for them to support, indicating to me that they're kind of aware that some of their decisions are more arbitrary in nature. But I think it's still important for us to know that the people of and constituencies out there really need to have a neutral party, and I believe that's very important. And with that, I'll turn it over to other testifiers.
Before I go to you, Mr. Coyle, are the two people from MnDOT, the legal counsel and the engineer, are they going to voice support today, or are they in opposition?
I believe they're still in opposition.
Okay. Mr. Coyle, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Peter Coyle. I'm counsel to Casey's General Stores for purposes of this legislation. Casey's is a regional convenience store chain that's based out of Iowa, but with about 140 retail locations throughout the state of Minnesota, primarily south, southwest, and the eastern or western half of the state. This issue arose as a result, in part, of Casey's experiences and the challenges they have in siting new store locations throughout Minnesota. But you have in your packet a letter endorsing the bill from a variety of other business trade groups whose members have also experienced this challenge. Members, as you know, very often in your communities, the state highway is the main street. And therefore, getting access to the state highway for businesses that are seeking to grow or expand or locate to a new community is really critical to the decision to move forward. In the case of my client, Casey's, they were here last week and visited with a few of you. They confirmed three different occasions within the last 24 months where their efforts to site a new retail location in a small town ultimately were unsuccessful because they were not able to gain approval from MnDOT for access to the state highway that happened to be the main street that they were choosing to locate their business on. It resulted in the loss of about a $3 million capital investment. It resulted in the loss of somewhere between 10 and 15 permanent and part-time employment opportunities. And it was a loss to the community as well, as those communities are trying to redevelop themselves and be successful for the future. So it's a pretty important issue, and we wouldn't have brought it to you if it wasn't something that was affecting businesses and property owners on a fairly constant basis. The result that the bill would seek to provide is no panacea. You still have to have somebody who is harmed enough that they're willing to hire counsel, bring an action in district court, recognizing that the courts still are usually inclined to defer to the agency's judgment about a regulatory matter of this sort. So it doesn't guarantee an outcome. It simply provides an avenue for an aggrieved property owner or a business owner who feels that it's necessary for them to raise the challenge to a neutral third party, in this case a district court, so that the evidence upon which the department is making its decision can be evaluated and determined to be proper, and in this case supported by clear and convincing evidence. That's the testimony in support of the bill, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to take questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Coyle. MnDOT folks, want to come up together? And if you're going to repeat your testimony, you could just have one testify. It's up to you. Go ahead with your name and title, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Brian Gage. I'm MnDOT's Access Management Engineer.
My name is Dave Socorro. I'm Associate Legal Counsel.
Okay, go ahead, whichever one you wish.
Okay, I'll start, Mr. Chair. Access management is really about balancing safety, mobility, and accessibility. Part of MnDOT's Towards Zero Death strategy is to implement proactive strategies that reduce crashes. We see this bill as a solution in search of a problem. This bill refers to denials and revocations. A denial for almost exclusively is an impasse between the conditions MnDOT is placing on a permit for the safe use of the highway and the applicant's view of what is reasonable for their business or their driveway desired use. Since 2013, MnDOT has approved about a thousand access permits, denying about 20, which is about 2%. In the handouts that I handed out, there's one starting with the graph on the back. That's the hierarchy when you look at access management. As you can see, mobility is really focused more on freeways, major arterials, expressways, where the access to the community and to businesses and property owners are really more towards the local street. MnDOT's responsibility lies in the highways on the mobility side of it. MnDOT manages and takes care of the interstates, the expressways, the major arterials. You know, these are for the regional travel in most cases. You know, none of us really wants to be crossing the state following a school bus that stops at every driveway along the way. Cities, counties, they're more on that local side. Their focus is really more on safety and accessibility to the property owners. Looking at the graph on the lower part of that sheet, national studies show a clear correlation between the number of driveways and the number of crashes out there. Similar information and data shows that there's a correlation between the numbers of driveways and reduced speed along these corridors. This information comes from the National Access Management Manual, which is a very large document right here. This one is really based on information gathered from across the nation, best practices, studies, and analysis. Minnesota's practices are cited in here as good examples and best practices in several cases. On the flip side of the diagram, I just provided some visuals to show what we show as good access, bad access. So if you look at it, on the top one, number one, stated Robert Street, that shows, you know, a congested roadway. There are many driveways along there. In about the two-block area you're looking at there right now, there's about 14 access points. And, you know, if you look at the movements in and out of those access points and the movements on the road, that's about 126 points where vehicles cross each other's paths and potential conflicts. On the flip side of that, number two, where you're looking at County Road 42 across Dakota County, that shows wider spacing of intersections, fewer driveways along there. The driveways that are along there really access multiple businesses. In the lower right corner, you see that there is a gas station and business that actually has access only off the local street and not off the county road. So that's a good example there. The second one, or third one there, Rice Street, that shows, again, another example of Rice Street, which was a former Minnesota state highway. But you see that, you know, there's multiple lanes, driveways close to the intersection. If you can look at it, there's a little car going northbound that's attempting to get into the gas station and make a left turn. It doesn't have a turn lane. It's trying to cross multiple lanes of traffic. There's backups in traffic. And it is actually sitting in the through traffic lane waiting to make this maneuver. So vehicles coming up behind it will have to weave around it through the turn lane or stack up and go through the intersection. The reverse example there on Highway or County Road 46 and I-35, you see that there are multiple businesses there that have access off the local road system that is actually backed up from the intersection, so there is room for traffic to queue up and not block traffic. And again, there's no access from these businesses directly to that main road, County Road 46. So, you know, MnDOT's role in access management is really about managing those conflict points on the trunk highway system. You know, this can be accomplished in multiple ways. You see it, obviously, as you're driving around the state when you look at some of our major construction projects. The work we've done on Highway 14, the Painesville bypass on Highway 23, the work's being done on Highway 12, Highway 55, and the work being done in Anoka County on Highway 10 around Ramsey and Anoka. We are reducing access points there and managing the system, but we are doing that by building interchanges, frontage roads, we're bypassing communities, and these are high-cost solutions. On the other hand, MnDOT does have authority to reasonably regulate access on the highways. Now, managing access through permitting is a very cost-effective approach to preserving the mobility and improving safety. MnDOT's access management or permitting process is an iterative process where MnDOT staff works with the applicant and with the local government to provide reasonably convenient and suitable access to the adjacent property owners while preventing interference with the interference of the safe use of the highway. Sometimes this may result in a recommendation that driveways and access is redirected to the local system or to a frontage road system and such. It doesn't always lead to a driveway onto the trunk highway system. You know, throughout this process, MnDOT applies appropriate criteria to the location based on the classification of the highway, what we look at as the existing traffic volumes and the future traffic volumes, the geometric conditions of the road area, is there site distance, is there a hill, how far it is from an intersection, and then the purpose of the driveway. Is it going to be a well-busy driveway? Is it going to be a less-used driveway? Is it for deliveries? Is it for customers? Things like that. This criteria is documented in MnDOT's own access management manual.
How much you got left, sir?
A very little.
Okay.
Okay. MnDOT's access management manual is includes an appeals process, as Representative Petersburg mentioned, that's been updated in the last 6 months. This process identifies timelines, clear procedural and communication steps, and roles and responsibilities. This process does not prevent a grieved person from seeking restitution in district court for damages. So in closing, MnDOT's has serious concerns about this bill. It adds an unnecessary complexity to our permitting process that is cited as a model in this national manual as a good example that's used by other states. It could lead to less safe driveways, reduced mobility on the state's highway system, and then in the end, it would cause us to pay more money for fixes in the future as we have to, address situations as traffic grows. So, thank you.
Thank you, sir. And could you, when you give your testimony, just not repeat anything the former gentleman has said, just cover your area?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will. And members of the committee, I'm Dave Sikora. The one point that I'd like to make this morning is that we feel this bill is unnecessary to protect the legal rights of property owners. There's already a right to go directly from a MnDOT decision on an application to the Court of Appeals, and in the nature of that case would be that we should have granted the permit, and if they prevail, the court would order the permit to be issued. There's also an avenue for the property owner to go into district court and make the case that they have been denied a reasonable and suitable access to the property, and if the court determines that they have been so denied, they would be awarded just compensation for that taking of the property right. Those exist under current law today. This bill would add yet another complex and expensive process in the courts for the same type of claim. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to address any questions that you may have.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my understanding is there's an ombudsman program in place, and you had mentioned 2% of the denials. How long has that program been in place, and what has been sort of the resolution with the ombudsman through a process where someone feel that their denial was not justified?
Mr. Chair, committee, when we first started this about 4, 5, 6 years ago was the same time MnDOT had started an ombudsman program. And so we had the ombudsman as being the conflict situation or handling the conflict here as far as if there was an impasse, it would go to the ombudsman's office. And since that time, the role of the ombudsman office has changed. And so that was part of the reason we had to move forward and adjust our process here was because the role of the ombudsman had changed. I do not have the specifics from the ombudsman's office on how many were resolved. We can get that information.
Representative Dean, follow up?
Yeah. Well, thank you. I would consider that somewhat critical because, if the one of the resolutions is an ombudsperson being involved in that process, we need to know if that's actually been used appropriately and if it's been implemented. I'm concerned a little bit about this bill because what it might mean to safety. Yesterday we had lots of discussion about safety on the roads, and if the ability of a store owner or a property owner to go through a process that they're more likely to prevail without really going through a process of doing analysis, appealing, seeing if there's an other options in ways of working, that concerns me a little bit. I have been on roads many times and highways, and you're traveling along at 55 and maybe 57 or 58 on a road, and all of a sudden someone pulls out in front of you, and if it's a two-lane highway and there's oncoming traffic the other way, generally the only place you have to escape is onto a shoulder, and if that's a soft shoulder, that creates a dangerous situation when you have to decelerate quickly. So I have a little bit of concern about this bill, and we'll hear what the rest of the questions yield us. Thank you.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, you said 2% approximately of the is the denial rate. And currently, what is the timeline when you get approached by someone that's been denied and by the time you give them a final resolution of your decision? And in, is it not true in both cases they can still go to court? But it's the timeline that concerns me.
Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chair and Representative Rosenthal, we're required to respond to applications for an access permit within 60 days. And then our internal appeal process may run an additional 60 days. So the time frame for dealing with and making a decision on the permit is up to 4 months.
The chair likes this bill. And the reason is because you guys do a good job overall, but sometimes you make bad decisions and they need an appeal. I've got a guy that I've been trying to put a sign up for his ski resort on Highway 22 for years and deny until he finally died. And then a couple of bad, well, questionable decisions on Highway 22 in Mapleton, one on 30 and one on Highway 22. And sometimes I think it's good for an extra set of eyes to look at this. And so I kind of favor this bill. So any other questions? Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I do like this bill, but I looked at this sheet they handed out with the pictures that shows basically downtown St. Paul on Robert Street, which is totally different traffic than the other two photos that are good, which is more of rural. In fact, it looks like an agricultural area next to it. But my question is, when these permits are denied in some of these, especially some of these small towns, the DOT is wanting to push them on side streets or rural streets, and what happens if these permits are denied and there is no side streets or no street nearby? Is this going to force the businesses that are looking in there to spend hundreds of thousands of dollars to put a road in so they can put their business in, and thus basically shut the door on these businesses to help these small communities grow and expand?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, no. If there's not a side street, then the access would be off the trunk highway. There is a responsibility of MnDOT to provide access to property that is otherwise landlocked, unless MnDOT has gone out there and at some point in time purchased the actual rights, like we do with the interstate system, from a property owner. So there's no legal right for that. But in other cases, like I said, if there is no other roads, if it's a farm entrance and there's no other driveway around, that right of access, MnDOT is responsible for providing access to that property. Then we go through the permitting process. It may determine what's the best location on there that works for the property owner and for MnDOT, looking at site distance and other things like that. But yeah, we cannot force someone not to have access to their property if there is no alternative. MnDOT working with the community, the local side streets are seen as reasonable access in some cases.
Public testimony, and sometime you guys got to tell me what happened in Belle Plaine. All the access to all those businesses on the right disappeared. Now I got to drive a half a mile and come back on a frontage road to get there. And I suppose it had something to do with safety, but what a pain in the neck. Public testimony.
I'm gonna legislate the world.
All right, without any, Representative Petersburg. Oh, Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Petersburg, if MnDOT were to deny something on safety concerns and Casey's appealed it and got it overturned, if there was a fatality there, who would assume the liability?
Representative Petersburg.
Mr. Chair and Representative Considine, the same liability would occur if it was an approved prior and not having any appeal. The situation is that at any intersection, there is a risk of liability in regards to access and et cetera. And so I don't think that changes whether there's an appeal process or not. The department, the drivers, and so forth will all through the court system be determined that appropriate liability issue. And so every situation would be unique and different in that regard.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I don't think it's quite that clear, because if MnDOT is saying that this would be unsafe and we don't want to do it, and they appeal, you have it. You have documentation that they considered it to be an unsafe situation, and that they were forced to do it. So I would be very concerned about that. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Any public testimony? If not, Representative Petersburg, I'll move your bill, House File 2014. Did we amend it? To go to Ways and Means. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Aye.
Okay, thank you, Representative Peter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
And Representative Nash. Chair will move House File 1291 be referred to the General Register. And any amendments? No amendments. Representative Nash, to your bill, House File 1291.
I appreciate it, Mr. Chair. Members, thank you for the opportunity to come and present House File 1291. Before you, I'll be brief, because Chair Cornish has already said that I don't have an option other than that. But in roughly 2013, prior to my time here in the legislature, a decision was made by court admin that really has adversely affected the townships in my district in Carver County, whereby any citation or violation that occurred previously, the funds that were created as a result of that fine used to go to the general fund for those townships. And as a result of the decision by court admin, they are no longer able to collect those because of a really kind of a disagreement as to who is the prosecuting attorney for the townships. And this bill clarifies that language, as you'll see on line 1.1 and 1.11, 1.12. Very straightforward, small piece of a tweak there that allows the county attorney to be the attorney of record. And this will allow for the townships in my district to begin receiving their two-thirds, again, of the citations fees that were generated. And quite honestly, I hear from the township supervisors, I hear from township residents on a regular basis that as a result of this, money not being directed towards their general fund, they are now no longer able to contract for the sheriff to do proactive patrolling in their area. So I hear from a lot of frantic moms and dads saying that you know, their kids are out on the township roads, driving to work, driving to school, kids are out, and a lot of folks are speeding up and down the roads. They're not able to contract because that general fund money is not there. So again, simple fix. I do have some testifiers that will speak to this bill. In your packets also, you have a letter from the county board in full support. All five members of our county board support this bill, and I would welcome my testifiers to come down to the table, and appreciate your support. Go ahead and introduce yourself.
With your name and title, sir.
Good morning, Chairman Cornish, members of the committee. My name is Peter Ivy, I-V-Y, spelled like poison. I am a prosecutor for Carver County since May 23rd, 1988. For decades, the Carver County Sheriff has contracted with various townships within Carver County for additional services above baseline service, as Representative Nash just indicated. I handed out, or you should have in front of you, two pages, Minnesota statutes applicable to township fine revenue. I took the liberty of highlighting some of the language in 48490 subdivision 6, which very clearly and specifically, without any ambiguity, states, in all cases prosecuted in district court by an attorney for a municipality or other subdivision within the county for violations of state statute or ordinance, those fines collected shall, mandatory shall, be be distributed, and you look under number two, two-thirds of all fines to the city or town. To me, that's very unambiguous language. What happened was, just about the time the state court administrator was about to roll out e-filing, which, by the way, is a great idea, they suddenly couldn't produce any ORI numbers because I suspect the computer program doesn't allow for it. And so they took all the other existing townships off the fine revenue. Since then, they've dropped the contracts with the sheriff. So not only do we have a public safety issue, we also have a revenue issue for the townships, which I believe is in violation of 48490 sub 6. I did have discussions with the attorney for the state court administrator's office. She went into analysis between township prosecutors and county prosecutors. I'll tell you, I've never seen a township prosecutor. County attorney always prosecutes both ordinances and misdemeanors on behalf of the townships. I requested an opinion from the attorney general. They deferred to the attorney for the state court administrator. So at this point, we're just out of the box. I think, frankly, the amendment to the statute's redundant, but if that gets the state administrator off the block and get us back on track, I'm fine with that. Two other things. I would note there was a case, interestingly enough, from Carver County in 1973, 211 Northwest 2nd at 516. That's when we still had municipal courts and district courts. The municipal court wasn't following the directive from the state to transfer two-thirds of the fine to the state for traffic and motor, to the state highway patrol. And the state brought a declaratory judgment against Carver County. So it's funny, this much later, we're almost in the opposite legal position where a declaratory judgment, I think, could be made against the state. In conclusion, I believe that the amendment to the statute would remedy the problem. I think it would be a message to the state court administrator's office that if they have a problem with their computer system, they need to fix that problem with the computer system. The statute is what should drive this vote. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I have also with me one of my township supervisors who has taken time out of his day to come and join us. And Mr. Johnson, if you'd...
You could just...
Go ahead and introduce yourself. Okay. Mr. Chair, my name is Neil Johnson. Neil Johnson, and I serve as chairman for Watertown Township, and I also serve as chairman for Carver County Association of Townships. So year after year in Watertown Township, we've been receiving $10,000 to $12,000 a year, and this is money through the revenues, through the citations issued within the township borders. So you receive the ticket, you pay the fine, two-thirds of it was coming back to us. As I understand it, we didn't. Now, we've been using this money to pay our police contract, as was stated. Now, as I understand it, we don't have to do it, but that's where our greatest need is, and that's where we have been using this money. So until 2013, sometime in the middle of 2013, we had a good system going, the revenues were flowing, and we had police protection. And then at some point, somebody in the state has decided we're no longer eligible for these revenues, and so now we've got the problem. Do we have police protection right now? Yes, we have police protection right now. If we have a violent crime, you call 911, the police are going to respond. But do we have any kind of misdemeanors, petty thief things? We don't get a response from the police department. So our community is like any other community. We have crime, we have petty crime, and we have to have it covered. We have to have police visibility within our community. And without it, we think that this petty stuff can eventually begin to escalate and become more serious. So the need is there. It's very important. So we feel that the money is collected in our township, comes out of our township borders, comes into the state, and it needs to be returned back so that we can use it for our police protection. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Sonnen, welcome back.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sulem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. We were brought into this situation in the summer of 2013 after the letter had come saying that the state was no longer authorizing sharing of the revenue. We talked it over and decided that it was definitely something that we would seek a legislative fix for. So in 2014, I attempted to have the bill jacketed. We waited. The author at that time made calls to the reviser staff. We waited. Finally, too late to get it done for that session, I was able to get a meeting with the reviser who said, well, we're not jacketing that because it's already law. We don't draft redundant law. They read it the exact same way we have always read it, that the county attorney is the town attorney, and therefore we are represented by counsel in court. To read it otherwise would be analogous to say that a public defender is not really the defendant's attorney, that there would be no attorney-client relationship in that situation, even though we are mandated to provide the service. We had been receiving revenues consistently until there was this computer change, and then also unilaterally we get letters saying, oh, sorry, you're not getting the money, even though the statutes very clearly state we're supposed to. The reviser wouldn't draft the bill at first because she said it was absolutely redundant. So it may be belts and suspenders, folks, but we need this to clarify the error. It's also important to remember that this is not a budget item. This is not something that's allocated to the courts. There is no tracking of this revenue in terms of the general fund and the fiscal impact of the budget that you as legislators have to approve. These are fine revenues that come in and have always been shared up until the last couple of years. So with that, I'll stand for questions.
Members, any questions? Representative Dean.
Actually, is it possible to get a report on where we are with a fiscal report? Because I'm assuming if money's coming out of the state general fund that it's going to somehow affect state revenue. So if you could just comment on where we're at in that process, or maybe Mr. Walls can comment.
Mr. Chair, I had a brief discussion about this issue with the courts last week when I put in a fiscal note request. That it came up sort of last minute, and the due date is today. There's yet no information in the system. The person I spoke to wasn't real familiar with the issue, and I was told this was a policy change that happened about 3 years ago. Where that money went is the question. Did it unwittingly get sent to the counties, and it was so small that they didn't know, or did it stay deposited in the general fund? The fiscal note should point out where that money went, and if it goes back to the townships, it will either be a loss to the counties or the loss to the state, but I or the person I spoke to did not know at the time.
Yeah. And if I could, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead if you know.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We don't have a specific number, Representative Dean. We talked to the various township supervisors, and as the township supervisor is here said, it's really no more than $10,000 per a couple of townships. And you know, Hollywood, Watertown Township, Laketown Township, Waconia Township being the larger of the townships. In consultation with our county board and various members, it's really not going to exceed $10,000 plus or minus per those townships. So while it is to the state an insignificant number, it is a very significant number to the townships as it relates to their ability to contract for the preventative and proactive policing of the townships, which is, as I had said earlier, a great concern for those residents who live there.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Nash. I understand that there's a few townships here, maybe in Carver County, that this affects, but this is a state law, and it's going to affect all the townships. And I mean, as I read the bill, it seems it's going to affect cities as well. So this could be a really significant number in the end, depending on what really happens.
We'll track it down if it is and bring it back or to deal with it. Mr. Sullivan from the township.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, I think you got to remember this is not having an impact on the cities. They have their statute for the fine revenue. This is only the revenue for offenses that occur within the township limits. And so it's always been separated from any city revenue, any county revenue. This money was always just the township revenue on the sharing. As far as impact to the state, again, it's not part of the budget, and we are not asking for retroactive payments. It'd be nice, but we're not seeking retroactive. This is just starting fresh again for the revenues that we had received up until this unilateral letter said that they weren't doing it.
Okay, any more questions from the members? Any testimony from the public? All right, no amendments. Representative Nash, just a short close and we're...
Mr. Chair, members, thank you for your support.
Okay. No more questions. The chair will move House File 1291 to be referred to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Okay, thank you, Representative
thank you.
Nash. Representative Lesh, House File 3622. There's no amendments. The chair will move House File 3622 to refer to the General Register. If you wouldn't have left a committee, you could have moved your own bill.
What's that?
If you wouldn't have left our committee, you could have moved your own bill.
I got kicked off because someone conflicted it with taxes, Mr. Chair. Otherwise, I feel at home being here. Thank you. Thank you for moving the bill, Mr. Chair. I guess what I would say is that this bill is a result of some legal changes in the courts that are modifying how we deal with implied consent. So as it stands now, historically, with the criminal law in DWIs, we have due process. We also have due process on the civil side with implied consent where your license is revoked. But because of recent court cases, specifically taking of blood and urine in order to determine blood alcohol content and the warrant requirement, that has also required some changes in law. If we are to maintain as a state the policy of suggesting that the most immediate an effective way of reducing DWIs is with the immediacy of the license revocation. If we are going to continue to do that, we need to make sure that the law applies as equally to the warrant requirement as it did historically with our implied consent process in the state of Minnesota. And I have a much smarter person than me here who can explain those details to you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, sir, go ahead with your name and organization and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Bernstein, and I'm the chair of Minnesota's DWI task force. This bill, as Representative Lesh says, is to keep up with changing trends in the law. The recent practice was that when a person is suspected of a DWI, the officer reads what's called the implied consent advisory. They then take a test. They can choose to refuse as well. But if they refuse or if the test comes out at 0.08 or more, their driver's license is revoked. They can go through ways of getting their license back or having a valid means of driving, for example, through the ignition interlock, but it ensures safe driving on the road that the revoked drivers are not driving. With the change in the law, there are two cases at the Minnesota Supreme Court that are currently pending, Thompson and Trahan. Those are scheduled to be heard the first week in June. There's also a case at the United States Supreme Court called Bernard. Because of these cases, law enforcement has been advised in cases involving blood and urine test results to obtain a search warrant as opposed to using the implied consent process. When an individual submits to a test pursuant to a search warrant and their test result is above a 0.08, their license is not revoked. And so the purpose of this bill is to equate the two processes and, with respect to the search warrants, have their license revoked just as it is with the implied consent process. I appreciate your consideration and be happy to answer any questions you have.
This isn't really a new procedure. It's because of the search warrant process that kind of circumvented it. Now we want to track it and make sure it was done like it was before that interruption.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. And one thing I do want to note as well, there is an appeal process for the license revocation. That's the last paragraph in the handout, typically referred to as an implied consent proceeding. The name implied consent comes from the name of the statute. That process would not change. And if their license is revoked pursuant to a search warrant, they would have that same appeal process.
Okay, members, any questions? Representative Howell. Oh, Representative Quam had his name on the list. Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I, you know, applaud the effort on this, and I really like it in connection with alcohol. But on page 2.4, if you can clarify, basically marijuana and some of the cannabinoids are not considered a violation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, that is considered a violation. This bill does not change this statute. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, what I'm trying to understand is This item three has to do with Schedule One, Schedule Two drugs. We have an issue of where many of those stay in the system, prescribed by a doctor, physician, stay in the system sometimes for weeks and months past where there would be effect or impairment, but people would get violation of DWI because there are not, you know, set limits on the tests. So when you're fixing this bill, there wasn't any effort to cover this. I just want to bring the attention of the author that it is a non-trivial issue of people, you know, following a doctor's prescription advice on the effects of impairment, waiting 48 hours, even a week, but still being forced by implied consent to, you can violate DWI, and I've heard before this committee people that have mentioned that. And so this is a good bill, but if we're going to clean stuff up, we should look at trying to protect the patients and the citizens and, clarify that part of the statute as well.
We had an earlier discussion within our caucus about prescription drugs and the problem. This doesn't change any of the procedure, make it any harder or more difficult to get tagged by the use of prescription drugs. I mean, it just follows what we've been doing, which was interrupted by the search warrant decision. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
I had Representative Howell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question is because we got those cases in front of the Supreme Court, why not wait for a ruling on those cases before we make a change? That way we have some clear guidance and direction on what we need to do.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howell, at the Minnesota Court of Appeals, they ruled in Trahan and Thompson that you need a search warrant to obtain blood and urine. That is the current state of the law that judges are following. And so in cases where blood or urine tests were obtained without a warrant or without a valid exception to the warrant, those cases are being thrown out. And so between now and June, in order to preserve DWI investigations and prosecutions, we need to follow the directives of the Minnesota Court of Appeals until the Supreme Court makes its decision. Oral arguments are scheduled for early June, but the Minnesota Supreme Court decision could take a long time to obtain.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hall.
So you're telling me we could come back 6, 8, 9 months from next session and revisit this thing again, depending upon what the Supreme Court decision?
Mr. Chair, Representative Howell, perhaps. One thing I do want to note is that there have been changes to warrant procedures, and we're now able to obtain warrants electronically. And that has sped up the process and has become much easier for law enforcement to obtain warrants. And so regardless of how the court cases come out, it may very well be that law enforcement continues to obtain warrants as well.
And how many DWIs will happen between now and next April? We've got a figure on that, don't we?
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chair, the last 2 years there have been over 25,000 DWIs in the state.
Okay, Representative Hilstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesher, your testifier. Now that we're saying that they can do this blood test and report, this isn't doing anything to the refusal of a crime, because now couldn't the defense say, well, you had the opportunity to take blood via search warrant and you didn't, therefore you shouldn't be allowed to charge me with refusal? Or does this have no impact on that?
Mr. Chair, if it's okay, I'll defer to Mr. Bernstein on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilstrom, this wouldn't necessarily change the refusal. That is being litigated at the United States Supreme Court with the Bernard case. Currently, the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision was that you can charge refusal. That could continue with search warrants. On the other hand, a search warrant is obtained through a signature by a judge establishing probable cause, and so the search warrant authorizes an officer to obtain a blood sample pursuant to a search warrant. This bill doesn't change any of those procedures.
Okay, questions, members? Representative Schoen.
Just while I have him here and can do this publicly, so do you see the future, Mr. Chair sir, do you see the future of DWI prosecution, arrest, and how we handle it needing a complete overhaul at some point in time? And here's why I ask. I mean, when I started in law enforcement, it was not the process it is now, and driving is a privilege, not a right, correct? And so we're at a point where we're seeing court rulings come down that see driving as a right, the way it's going. So are we going to continue this? I mean, the way, and sorry to the lawyers in the room, but DWI is a moneymaker for lawyers, and that's what it is. You got a civil process and a criminal process, and that is billable every time you turn around. And this is, it gets infuriating as an officer when someone is off the street for 2, 3, now 4 hours sometimes trying to deal with the DWI arrest. And so I think you're going to see some of them go down over time because it's going to be like, why bother? Because clearly we don't truly care that these are being dealt with. That's the frustrating part that I see from within the business, and that the community after a while wants these things dealt with. I mean, because people shouldn't be driving drunk on the streets, right? But what are we actually doing? So
short answer, if you could.
Mr. Chair, Representative Choen, very valid points, well taken. There's a lot of confusion amongst law enforcement as to how to process DWIs right now. I do think with the invention of electronic warrants that will simplify the process. We intend to tie this into e-charging, hopefully, to streamline the process and make it much easier. As far as how DWIs are processed in the future, I think the Minnesota Supreme Court, United States Supreme Court will tell us. But until that time, prosecutors are giving law enforcement our best advice as to how to treat DWIs.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could just respond briefly.
Very shortly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Choen. Part of the reason why there are more lawyers in the process is both Chapter 169A, criminal side to DWI, and implied consent are a lot longer and more complicated than they were 30 years ago. I mean, substantially longer. And so back when it was simple and straightforward, you maybe didn't need a lawyer, but now it just gets more complicated, especially with the court rulings. So just a little defense for the lawyers out there on both sides.
Representative Shaw and I could talk another hour about that, couldn't we? Okay. Any public testimony? Seeing none and no further questions, the chair will move House File 3622. We didn't amend it. To refer to the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you, Representative Galesh.
Thank
We're
going to
switch gears here and move Representative Zerwas up on the bill here, House File 2803. Representative Zerwas, you can move your own bill to the register. Representative Zerwas, to your bill.
Mr. Chair and members, I will move House File 2803 be referred to the general register.
Okay, to your bill, Representative Zerwas. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'll be brief. This bill is designed to help law enforcement as they deal with 72-hour holds, to clarify language in the law that as someone is being released from a 72-hour hold, discharged, or perhaps when they get to a facility and they're not admitted at all, that when that person does leave or leaves against on their own, that the submitting agency and that officer is contacted. And so the challenge that we have and the concern that we have is oftentimes law enforcement agencies are called out to respond to an issue with someone who's maybe having a mental health crisis while at home with a parent or at a place of residence with a spouse or a girlfriend or a boyfriend, and 911 is called because of that disturbance, and the person is then transported to a medical facility for a 72-hour hold. The concern is that if that person stabilizes and then is released without being processed or released sometime during that 72-hour hold, family and other folks that may have reported the initial incident believe this person is being held for 72 hours. And so upon their release, the submitting agency, if they could be notified, just in case there would be a public health or public safety issue. I have with me the police chief from St. Anthony, who's been working on this within Hennepin County, and he can speak to some of the law enforcement issues with the bill.
Your name and title, sir, and begin.
John Old, Chief of Police for the City of St. Anthony. Mr. Chair, members, we became aware of this statute, and subsequently I met with Bill Neiman, who is the Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, works with the hospitals in Hennepin County, as well as Leah Kaiser, who's the Behavioral Health Area Manager. We then went around to the four major hospitals in Hennepin and actually were simply making them aware of the statute. All the hospitals agreed that the statute was reasonable, but there was two loopholes that they saw that they wished clarification, which brings us here today. The first of which was when we sign a transport hold on these individuals and they're brought down to the hospital, sometimes they're triaged and released. If they didn't get brought into the 72-hour hold process, the hospital staff felt that they were unable to notify law enforcement that they were released. Secondly, when these individuals were brought down and went in voluntarily, again, felt that they weren't on the actual 72-hour hold, and again felt that there needed to be some clarification on whether or not they could notify law enforcement under those circumstances. I think the statute, as it's written, is pretty clear on what the intent was, and we're hoping for some clarification there.
Okay, members, questions? Any public testimony? Seems like a good bill, Representative Drosser. Thank you, Chief. And without any questions or testimony, the chair would move. Or no, you can move. I'm sorry.
I'll renew my motion, Mr. Chair, that this be referred to the General Register.
Representative Zerowas renews his motion 2803 to refer to the General Register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Lohmer, 3369. Representative Lohmer, you can move your own bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. I move House File 3369. And I'm not sure where it's going to the General.
General Register.
General Register, great. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for hearing House File 3369 today. I'll share just a brief explanation of what this bill is intending to do, and then I will introduce to you my testifier. So current Minnesota laws do not consider sensory testing services and their unique yet critical role in product development and quality assurance. The bill in front of you today will allow St. Croix Sensory to conduct sensory evaluation of products containing alcohol under the controlled, direct oversight of the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. This includes purchase of products through a wholesaler, holding product on site and presentation of samples, to a trained testing panel of assessors. The bill has been reviewed and is supported by Michelle Tushner, Director of Minnesota DPS, and to this point has had no opposition. So I'd like to introduce to you my testifier, Michael McGinley. He's Laboratory Director of St. Croix Sensory. Michael is second generation owner of a sensory testing business started in Stillwater in 1980. St. Croix Sensory conducts sensory testing studies on products and materials for companies all over the world. St. Croix Sensory has recently responded to inquiries for sensory testing services for products containing alcohol from companies throughout the U.S., Mexico, and South America.
Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Chairman Committee. My name is Michael McGinley with company St. Croix Sensory. We are a family business in Stillwater. We've grown from the initial area of the business was in nuisance odor, helping landfills, wastewater treatment plants, other stinky businesses deal with their odors. And over the years, as we've grown, we've looked at other niche areas that we can keep expanding into. Currently, we do work in product testing, fragrances, air fresheners, air cleaners, also work in municipal and bottled drinking water, energy drinks, and so forth. What we're looking to advance into is doing further sensory testing work into alcohol beverage area. In doing that, the work we do is not with the general public. We're not looking for opinions of what's good tasting or other opinions of the public. It's using a trained group of experienced and then ultimately expert assessors who are evaluating what would be called attributes of the product. So helping companies look in detail at the product regardless of whether people like it or not. So it's a slightly different approach than traditional market research looks at products. So currently, in order to do this, I would need to contract with a catering agency, which adds significant costs. And as I've looked at some recent projects with one of the, I think it was the third largest brewer in the world, it adds a significant cost to be working with a caterer for the ongoing work. So we're seeking this bill to give us direct oversight with the Department of Public Safety and allow us to do this work in controlled ways that follow industry accepted standards in the testing. So I'm happy to answer any questions.
Is this an agency bill, Representative Lemur?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, but we did meet with the agency.
But there's no problems from the state or anything on this. So.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Anybody from the questions? Representative Hillstrom and Considine.
No, I was.
Oh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question. So on line 1.10, it says that the trained sensory assessors must be at least 21 years of age. So you're only going to be testing on people 21 years or older. There will be no testing on anyone that's not legal age.
Absolutely. It would just be bringing in.
Go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt you. Yeah, it would only be recruiting people who are over 21 years of age to then become assessors, and they'd go through a training process and then what would ultimately be an apprenticeship process to become equivalent to the other members that are all part of the pool already.
Okay, questions? Representative Howell.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, what kind of training do you take? I mean, I guess I'm a little question of how you, what kind of process you go through to be a trained tester.
In sensory testing, it's experiencing the variety of products. So in this type of work, normally you would recruit a group who would become, for example, a beer panel. And they would be brought up to understanding definitions of different attributes of the product. So again, it's looking at what's the weedy flavor, earthy notes, other kind of attributes of that product, and being able to rate strengths of those products. So it's an experiential training that takes them down that process, but also training that involves health and safety aspects too. And of course, with this type of work, that becomes a big component of that.
How do you get to be one? Mm-hmm. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. His answer just caused me to raise another question. So, as you were talking about training for sensory, you were talking about training for, you know, what's in the product. Will you also be conducting training on the actual impact? So, will you be having folks drink to the point of to figure out when they become 0.08 or when they become 0.10 or any of those kinds of like limit type testing, and who will be watching to make sure that you aren't drinking, that someone isn't drinking to the point of, you know, near death experiences?
Thank you. Very good point. Very good questions. No, we would not be looking at, you know, questions of health impact or brain impact type of things. This would simply be looking at sensory aspects of taste and smell of the product. There's ASTM methodology that exists in serving of alcohol that gives recommendations of volumes over time, and there's other documents that exist in looking at weight of a person and so forth. As we